is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, are all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a podcast and radio show where we learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. Episodes are a variety of interviews, news stories, book movie reviews, and event coverage, which is today's episode. So over the weekend, geneticists, genetic counselors, professors, researchers, and students gathered at the University of Connecticut, or UConn, to learn about a new technology that has taken over labs and stolen headlines. And this technology has become the new star in genetic editing technologies. And in the future, it'll actually be a star in a television show with Jennifer Lopez. But we're a few years off from that, but it is coming down the pipeline. This technology is called CRISPR. Within the biotech, genetic editing, gene therapy world, you can't avoid the buzzwords phrasing surrounding CRISPR, such as gene editing, cure genetic disease, drug discovery, and crop saving. Now, the term CRISPR was coined in 2002, but we've only been using the technology since 2012, so it's only about 5 years old. And what exactly has this technology been able to do? It's hitting all of these headlines, but where have we actually gotten with this? What has it contributed to research? So in today's episode, I'm going to be discussing its impact on specifically imprinting disorders, as that was the focus of UConn's event where all of these people in genetics gathered. Now, the next question you're probably wondering is, what is imprinting? So I'll kind of go over the general idea of it. Genomic imprinting is an epigenetic occurrence where specific genes are silenced based on which parent that chromosome was inherited from. So instead of genes being expressed from both chromosomes, because remember, we get one set of 23 from mom, one set of 23 from dad, and they all pair together. So certain genes are silenced or inactivated on one chromosome. For example, a gene from a father, if that's imprinted, it's silenced. And that gene will only be expressed by the gene inherited from the mother. So it's important to note that not all genes are imprinted. Only some have this effect. But where it does have an effect, you have one imprinted or silenced and the other one is activated. So not both are activated. And the other word that I keep mentioning, CRISPR. CRISPR stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeat, which is a mouthful, so we call it CRISPR. And it's known as this gene editing technology. And what that really means is it can delete and replace genes, which is referred to as editing the genome. But an interesting thing that I learned at this conference was that you can also use CRISPR to modify the epigenome. And the epigenome is a collection of the DNA modification that does not actually change the DNA sequence, but rather it affects the activity of the genes and which genes are being expressed and at what rate. So it's not actually the DNA that's changing, but how the DNA is controlled. So to understand this better, I think of the genome as a piano, and the piano keys being different genes. Now, editing the genome would be like taking a key out or replacing one, the physical key on the piano. Whereas modifying the epigenome would change which notes or keys, right, are actually being played and how often they're being played. So that would be modifying the epigenome, how things are played. Now the physical keys would be editing the genome itself. CRISPR can accomplish both of these things. It can be editing the DNA or genome, but it can also edit how it's being played or expressed. During his presentation, Chris Stotter, who operates the Human Genetic Editing Core at UConn Health, explained where CRISPR originated, how we adapt it to then use it in the lab, and these two different CRISPR methods I just talked about of editing the genome, but also editing the epigenome. I caught up with Chris after his presentation to learn more.
So CRISPRs come from the bacterial adaptive immune system. What they are is a way for bacteria to recognize invading DNA and to destroy it, so that once a bacteriophage does infect a bacteria and the bacteria survives, it has a memory of that DNA. So then a later transduction by that bacteriophage will get destroyed and the bacteria will survive.
So for bacteria, it's kind of like their own immune system. Like, I've seen this before. Now I know how to attack it, and they keep that memory?
Yes. It's an adaptive immune system. So every time they get attacked by a virus and survive that attack, they incorporate part of the genome from that virus. And then when that bacteria divides, all of its descendants remember it. So this CRISPR locus just keeps growing and growing and growing and growing. So all descendants from a bacteria will contain the previous learned ones and newer ones.
So with this in mind, it's CRISPR is naturally occurring in this bacteria. Now, how do we actually use CRISPR in a laboratory in terms of, you know, gene editing and changing things? Is it a little bit different from in bacteria?
Yes. So what they needed to do is they needed to adapt it for use in mammalian systems, because it's originally from a prokaryotic system, and we want to use it in eukaryotics. So what needs to be done is you need to change all the codons in the RNA to code for amino acids and transfer RNAs that are present in mammalian cells versus bacteria cells. So what Feng Zhang did at MIT was go through and kind of humanize all the codons so that they're able to be represented in a mammalian system versus a bacterial system. So that meant changing promoters, changing polyadenylation sites, and actually changing the coding sequence of the gene. So it's still going to make the same protein, but we need to change the codons, which code for amino acids, so that they're available to be made in the human system.
And so one way of using CRISPR is to kind of use them as molecular scissors and identify with a guide RNA of where you want to be cutting in the DNA and then maybe introducing a new gene. So how does that kind of work? That's the basic explanation, but what's your expert answer?
So basically what we're doing with CRISPRs and the mammalian system is all we're doing is directing a double-stranded break in the DNA. There's nothing more than that's all the CRISPR is doing is cutting DNA, which stimulates a repair pathway. And then if we include DNA into that system, it'll use that as a template to repair the double-stranded break. If you don't include any kind of template DNA, it'll repair it by non-homologous end joining and create mutations. So all the CRISPR is physically doing is making a double-stranded break at a loci in the genome where you want it. That recruits in these proteins to do the work for you.
And so that's one way that I've personally kind of read about. But today I learned that you can actually change the epigenome with CRISPR. So explain that to me.
Yeah, so in Cas9, there's two catalytically active domains. If you mutate those domains, it becomes a dead Cas9. Therefore, it won't cut the DNA anymore. But it still has a property of being an RNA-guided protein. So you can localize that protein at any spot in the genome. And you can fuse on other effector proteins onto that Cas9 and carry them along with it as cargo to that location. So you can use things like CRAB domains, which recruit in methylation, which will silence genes. You can do the opposite and bring in the acetyl transferases, which will acetylate histones, which will activate genes. And you can even repress them even further by using de novo methyl transferases, which will then repress genes, but be long-term.
So for these, it's kind of like the guide RNA, it's kind of the driver, and it brings it down to the DNA exactly where it wants to go, but it has this protein with it that kind of prevents things from being transcribed?
Yeah, so the guide RNA will be like your GPS. It'll tell where the Cas9 to go to, and in the trunk of the Cas9 will be this cargo, and the cargo is your effector proteins, which will do the work on the epigenome. You can use, you know, like TET1 would be a demethylase, so you can remove methylation. So methylation on CpG islands and on histones causes repression. We can remove those methyl groups, which will open up the chromatin and allow the genes to be expressed. We can do the reverse with the CRAB domain. We can recruit in methylation, and which will silence the genes. So by using a different cargos hooked onto the Cas9, we can affect how the chromatin state is in the cell, and that'll change expression.
And so by changing expression, we're changing of what genes are actually being turned into protein. So you're changing kind of what's being actually expressed into the body.
Correct, yeah. You can have a cell which doesn't express a certain protein, and if you put this cargo in, that'll make it express. Now you have a cell that's making this protein. The same conversely, if you have a protein being made and you want to silence it to learn how that protein causes downstream effects, you can silence that protein. And what's nice about these is they're reversible too. So they're induced by doxycycline. So the dCas9 CRAB is not made until you add doxycycline to the media culture. When you do that, it turns on, so you get repression. You remove that, it'll turn off, and you'll get activation of the gene again. So you can really study downstream effects of genes one at a time.
And you've been studying this and kind of seeing all of these effects and kind of figuring out the process and how everything works. It sounds like this could really be big in terms of having lots of impacts in lots of fields. Have you seen or read about certain things that are already having an impact? Because the potential is out there for a lot. But what have you seen that things are starting for clinical trials or more research is being done to fine-tune some processes? It's a big question, isn't it?
Yes. Right now, clinical-wise, CRISPRs aren't really that available to use because of the off-target effect problem, and you don't want to be introducing something that you don't really understand.
And for off-target, you mean that it's not maybe going to exactly the place in the DNA that you want it to, so it's affecting other places?
Right, so this guide RNA would be 20 base pairs long, and so if you have something that matches like 17 or 18 base pairs, it's possible that that guide RNA could bring the Cas9 to there and do things that you don't expect it to that might be bad for the cell. So for any kind of clinical use, any kind of guide RNA has to be like really stringently tested and approved by the FDA to use. But in some studies, there has been some good work. One of them I've seen is muscular dystrophy, where you have a frame shift from an exon, and so you have an early termination, so the dystrophin protein isn't made properly. But what they found is if you remove an internal fragment of that protein, it'll then move the whole protein in frame, and the protein can function without the middle exons, but as long as you have the beginning and the end, it'll still work. So you can turn muscular dystrophy into a working protein.
And this is just one of many possible gene therapies, I guess we can say, right?
Yes. Yep.
Gene therapies that could be used. I've heard that sickle cell is also being looked at, and a lot of other things, because if we can take a gene out or change it a little bit, we're talking about a lot of different genetic disorders.
Correct, yeah. So right now with beta thalassemia or sickle cell, they're using zinc fingers have been approved by the FDA to use, and they're actually using those to treat patients with it, and it seems to work well. CRISPRs would be easier to do, but again, they need to go through the approval process before you would use anything with them.
That was Chris Stoddard from UConn Health. Another interesting presentation was from Dr. Michael O'Neill, who is the Assistant Director of the Institute for System Genomics and also an Associate Professor at UConn. He is studying autism spectrum disorder, specifically in the mouse X chromosome and how genes on it may play a role in this disorder. To conduct this research, he's using CRISPR, of course. That's why I'm talking about it. And although there's estimated to be around 1,000 genes that play a role in autism spectrum disorder, Dr. O'Neill is focused on genes in the X chromosome. And you may ask, why the X chromosome? You have lots of different chromosomes to pick from. But since this disorder affects males more than females at a 4-to-1 ratio, the thought is that some of the genes involved in the disorder could be X-linked. So now what you say, what does X-linked mean? So here's how X-linked disorders work. Females have two X chromosomes, and males have one X and one Y chromosome. So if a female has a recessive mutation on an X chromosome and a normal copy of the gene on her other X chromosome, the latter chromosome will compensate. So the X chromosome without the mutation is going to be expressed, like we talked about, turned into a protein. But if a male has a recessive mutation on their X chromosome, they don't have another X chromosome to compensate. So disorders that have genes on X chromosomes tend to affect males more, which is known as the X-linked disorders, and that's kind of the science behind it in terms of males being affected more. The mutations that have been associated with autism are fairly common, and Dr. O'Neill explains that it's only when dozens of these mutations are all brought together that a threshold is reached for a poor person to be on the autism spectrum. To conduct this research, Dr. O'Neill is using mice cells with Turner syndrome, which is a sex chromosome syndrome. So instead of mice having two X chromosomes or an XY chromosome, those are the two types of sex chromosomes, these mice only have one X chromosome, which is known as Turner syndrome. And this occurs in humans as well. And the single X chromosome that these mice have are also identified as either being inherited from their mother or father. So when we inherit our chromosomes, for each set, one is inherited from our mother and one from the father, unless something a little different is happening. So when Dr. O'Neill is identifying these chromosomes, he's identifying them as maternal or paternal, depending on where that X chromosome actually came from, which parent it was inherited from. And genes are naturally turned on or off, meaning that when genes are on, a protein can be produced based on the instruction a gene provides. We hear that genes are the blueprints to actually make the proteins. However, this process of gene expression isn't as simple as on or off. There's also dominant and recessive expression, which is where it gets a little bit more complicated than the flick of a switch, where you can kind of have more of a gradient, like how you can dim a light. It's not on or off, but it can kind of be dimmed. Now, Dr. O'Neill is using CRISPR to explore this gene expression rates of the X chromosome in the mice with Turner syndrome. Remember, they only have one X chromosome. And he makes a note between the difference seen between mice that inherited that X chromosome from their father, making it a paternal X chromosome, or if they inherited it from their mother, making it a maternal X chromosome. This event was full of interesting presentations, and two that complement each other were from Dr. Stormy Chamberlain and Dr. Mark Lalonde, and they are both pioneers in researching the imprinting disorders, Angelman syndrome and Prader-Willi syndrome. And these two disorders don't appear to be similar. So Angelman syndrome, those patients suffer from a lack of speech, seizures, and walking and balancing issues, whereas Prader-Willi syndrome symptoms include obesity, intellectual disability, and shortness in height, among other things, but those are some of the highlights of different symptoms that patients can have that are affected by these disorders. So here's the catch and how these are related. These disorders are caused by the same genetic mutation. So, or, you know, we can also say that they're caused by the same gene. A small deletion in chromosome 15 is what's causing this. In most cases, there's a couple different ways that this disorder, these two syndromes actually, can occur, but it all comes down to a few genes that are on chromosome 15. So how does the same deletion or how do these genes cause two different disorders that don't seem to be alike? I'm not listing any symptoms that are the same. It depends which of the allele chromosome 15 that the deletion is on. So I keep talking about maternal and paternal chromosomes. So this is where that comes into play again. If the deletion is on the chromosome that was inherited from the mother, the patient is Angelman syndrome. But if the same deletion is on the chromosome that was inherited from the father, that patient has Prader-Willi syndrome. And we're talking about the same chromosome, same area on the chromosome. It's even a micro deletion, so it's a small deletion on chromosome 15. But depending on where that deletion is, if it's on a chromosome 15 that was inherited from the father versus the mother, you're going to have these two different syndromes. Now, the syndromes can also be caused, I said, by a couple different things, so I want to go over what those are, one of which is uniparental isodisomy, which is just a bunch of words, right? So what this means is that I said that you inherit usually a chromosome from your mother and your father for chromosome 15, one 15 from your mom, one from your dad. But in this case, both 15s are inherited from the same parent, so they're both going to be maternal or they're both going to be paternal. Another type, another way that these syndromes can be caused is by translocation, where chromosomes actually swap portions of their DNA so that the gene positions vary and what genes they're next to, which can affect a lot of different things. And epigenetic issues. You should be familiar with this word at this point in the episode. That's where genes are not being expressed or they're being expressed. So different issues within the epigenome. Now, Dr. Stormy Chamberlain is researching Angelman syndrome, and she's looking at neuron cells since this is a neuronal disorder. These cells are also induced pluripotent stem cells. And the neuron cells have a point mutation in the UBE3A gene, and therefore they have Angelman syndrome, these cells. They have a mutation within this gene that causes Angelman syndrome. She then designed a CRISPR that specifically targets this mutation so that it can go to that point in the DNA and replace the gene. So it's a point mutation, which just means that one letter is different in that whole gene. So an A, T, C, or G, if we remember the nucleotides that make up our DNA strand. So one of those is off. That's what a point mutation is. And an interesting find in this gene is that it's imprinted in neurons, but not in most other cell types. Dr. Mark Lalonde is researching if he can turn on imprinted or silenced copies of genes in Prader-Willi syndrome. So now he's looking at the other syndrome. Dr. Stormy Chamberlain is looking at Angelman syndrome, and Dr. Mark Lalonde is looking at Prader-Willi syndrome. And so he's looking at turning on genes that are turned off. So he's looking to make that switch. And remember, we're talking about chromosome 15 if we're talking about Prader-Willi syndrome. And the genes on the chromosome from the mother are the ones that are imprinted and turned off. So he's looking at turning these on. And Dr. Lalonde is attempting to do this in order to kind of prevent Prader-Willi syndrome or kind of fix it in these cells that he's looking at. And it starts with figuring out which genes are the most important in the deletion, because there's a lot that are deleted in this case. And so he's looking at which are the important ones to be able to turn back on. So just like Dr. Chamberlain, Dr. Lalonde is using CRISPR on neuron cells to conduct this research, and it seemed to work. He shared that during the presentation that his research is going really well. So a couple of interesting things about Prader-Willi syndrome. It's a very interesting disease from a historical perspective, as it kind of has these three firsts. So it was the first recognized microdeletion syndrome, which means it's a really small deletion on that chromosome. And it was the first recognized human imprinting disorder. So we keep talking about imprinting, of silencing a gene, turning it off based on which parent it was from. And it's also the first condition known to result from uniparental isodisomy. So that's where, instead of getting a chromosome from each parent, you get two chromosomes from the same parent. So in this case, two chromosome 15s from either mom or dad. If you want to learn more about genetics, technology, and research, like I discussed on this episode of CRISPR and imprinting disorders, UConn offers phenomenal undergraduate and graduate programs like the Diagnostic Genetic Sciences program and the Professional Science Master's program. I'm biased. I just graduated from their undergraduate DGS program. That's what we call the genetics one. You can check out more information at alliedhealth.genetics.ucon.edu and psm.ucon.edu. They have lots of new information on there, and the DGS website is new. If you have questions, you can definitely find a contact form or email on that, or email me. I'll share at the end of the episode. UConn's also going to have a genetic counseling graduate program in the near future. I've talked about that before. I had Brittany Gancars, a prenatal genetic counselor at UConn Health, come on the program and talk about that. So I'll be providing more details as they're announced. There's not too much information out there yet, but as they roll out, I'll definitely be sharing that on the program. If you're interested in hearing more of these episodes, you can go to dnapodcast.com. I have all the episodes on there and information to contact. If you're looking to stay updated on genetic news, at DNA Podcast on Twitter, and the email that I told you I would share, info@dnapodcast.com. And to get episodes straight to your phones, tablets, and laptops, you can go to your favorite podcasting app and find DNA Podcast on there, or DNA Today, probably listed as DNA Today. Reviews are really appreciated on those, especially iTunes. Thanks for listening, and join me next week to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
We're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made